Hi, I'm Dr. Stan Steindl, and welcome back to Compassion in a T-shirt, where we explore the science and practice of compassion and how it can truly transform lives. Today, I'm honored to introduce a very special guest, Professor Rhonda McGee. Rhonda is a law professor, mindfulness teacher, and a pioneering voice in the intersection of mindfulness, compassion, and social justice. She's the author of The Inner Work of Racial Justice, and her work challenges us to reflect on how mindfulness can help us to address racism, inequality, and healing from trauma. In this episode, we'll dive into how mindfulness can be a tool for social change, the importance of care and compassion, and the inner work we all need to do to create change both within ourselves and across society. This conversation was enlightening and deeply inspiring. So get ready to explore how mindfulness and compassion can transform not only ourselves, but our communities. And now I bring you Professor Rhonda McGee.
Well, Professor Rhonda McGee, welcome to Compassion in a T-shirt.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be talking with you. Although I do have a T-shirt underneath, and it actually even has a peace sign on it.
Oh, there you go.
It's just to sort of reward the spirit of the
theme. Love us. Yes. Yes. Well, I have my Compassion T-shirt on, so
there we go.
I have a range of these in my cupboard. So
wonderful.
Just to spread the word, but yeah. Yeah, I guess I sort of wondered about, before getting into specifics, I sort of wondered about whether we could start with you giving us a kind of overarching view, I suppose, of your approach, maybe, like just sort of, and perhaps some of the guiding principles, I guess, that might be behind things for you. Would that be okay?
Of course. What a lovely question. Where shall I begin? I certainly, as a core principle, I think bringing awareness to a deeper sense of who we are, and a commitment to doing that in a variety of ways. In my work and in my own life, actually, becoming more present to some of the ways that conventional ideas about identity and about what it means to kind of be alive and to be successful and as a human being in these bodies, you know, I think conventional ideas about that can cause a lot of pain and suffering, actually. So opening up a sense of what seems to be more true than is always advertised or presented to us in our socialization experiences. You know, disrupting, for example, hard-bounded notions of separate self, hyper-individualized notions of what it means to kind of be a personality in the world and to move through the world successfully. And opening up more of the sense of interconnectedness, the sense of our really belonging not only to the planet, which is somehow miraculously selected for all of us without our being involved in that. And in that way, you know, I have a fundamental sense that we all already belong and that this is all our mutual one address, really. And all of the ways that we tend to separate are kind of just, you know, man-made temporary projects. So these are some of the the underlying orientations, the work that I do, which makes it a little bit challenging as a person in academia on the one hand, in legal academia. I think I have been drawn to mindfulness as a way to kind of soften some of the ways that law in particular contributes to our confusion about who we really are and our, you know, hyper individualizations and our adversariness and our you know, our alienation from ourselves and the planet. I mean, so I think law for me has been a place where I've tried to do some repair work, and bringing mindfulness to law has been part of that project.
Oh, that really, yeah, that definitely kind of sets the scene. I really appreciate that idea of, it's in some ways it's conventional ideas that we're trying to kind of explore, bring awareness to, perhaps, you know, sort of even dismantle a little bit or kind of change, maybe even disruption to a degree. Yeah. You know, like it and but you know, in a sense it's kind of it's conventional ideas. It's things that themselves have evolved, I guess, over the years, and kind of many of which were also kind of made for us, or we inherited in a sense. And so it's kind of, yeah, bringing awareness to that, to those kind of conventions, those sort of rules, those sometimes unconscious even rules or
so
conventions.
Yeah. These, yeah, often unconscious, but certainly we've received and inherited.
Yes.
And again, you know, big part of that aspect of what it means to move through the world as humans is something for which, you know, I personally feel grateful. In other words, yeah, there's a way in which kind of holding things through multiple lenses is part of also kind of an underlying principle and something I think mindfulness can help us with, so that, you know, the tendency that I received through my, you know, education, not only in law, but certainly in law, to put things in kind of separate concrete boxes and or to create binaries, something is either this or that. You know, to me, that is something that as a Westerner raised in the United States, and I don't think it's only in the West that we do these things. I think some of this is just the way the brain cognizes the world, to put things in categories and then try and rank order them and try and, you know, constantly be in a position of controlling or predicting risks around these, the notions that we hold about the world, concepts, et cetera. So I know this is sort of what the brain does to move through the world as best we can, right? Mm-hmm. The way the way the brain does that can be a trap. Because, you know, some of the ways that we have been given to do that don't actually represent fully what seems to be, you know, true. In other words, we oversubscribe to certain binaries, certain concepts, things that we receive, teachings we learned that we inherited, that are, you know, maybe our evidence in, you know, the life that we're living right now tells us maybe aren't the whole story. So being open to really examining the kind of disconnect between conventional ways of knowing the world, describing ourselves, being in relationship with others, and, you know, what might be called for to create more of a sense of liberation, more of a sense that the map we have about the world actually really well suits the reality that we're living.
Yeah. No, it's the classic sort of trade-offs of evolution in a way, isn't it? That the brain kind of, I guess, formed millions of years ago to try to deal with threats. And one of the threats might have been another group of kind of humans sort of down the way or something like that. And so we developed this kind of pattern recognition thing to create a sense of friend and foe or something like that. And perhaps it even helped with survival to a degree or whatever. But a lot of time's passed since then and things have changed and there are trade-offs. And in fact, a lot of those ideas that kind of get passed down and get inherited actually now really are a source of suffering more so than a source of perhaps safety or something like that. And I guess that one of the areas, of course, is the notion of differences with others and the way that we can sort of react and respond to those that are somehow different to us, and racism as a kind of a manifestation of that and a source of suffering. I know a lot of your work is in that area. I wonder if you could sort of help us understand some of those ideas, racism, inequality, privilege. Would you be able to just sort of help us with some of that?
Yeah, I think there's a, as we're talking about the different ways we tend to conceive of or conceptualize reality in the world, we're these, in these bodies, we're in that, we're thrown into these sort of social contexts and situations where even, in ways that vary depending on where we are and culture we're in, what era we're living in, we are sort of thrown into all kinds of what in sociology we call projects in a way, but like ways that the world, the place that we're in, the group that we're living in, the culture we're in defines us. In the U.S., right at birth, you get this birth certificate and there's a race, your name, who your parents are, all these things are kind of part of the state's project for identifying and kind of administering, keeping track of who's who. But that means then that very early on, in ways that we don't typically have very much choice, we are being identified in these socially cognizable terms. So in the United States, there's a racial designation, there's a gender designation. And we know that, for example, with regard to gender, ways that we're thinking about gender, traditionally, when I was born, way back in the last century, there was much more of a conventional sense that
me too.
Right. Gender is a binary, male or female. And now we know that there are efforts, I think, helpfully underway to expand how we think about the possible and expand how we what we know about how people are experiencing gender. And certainly would self and to identify that go beyond those binaries. Race, gender, there's so many different ways that we are identified, and they vary depending on our social context. And, I was trained in sociology at the graduate level before I went to law school, so I tend to lean into these sociological ways of thinking about things, but social psychologists and sociologists tell us that across cultures, we tend to come up with some sort of salient social categories. The particular categories may vary, right? Persistently across cultures, gender and age. So we categorize according to gender and we categorize according to age. And then we assign value and meaning, often rank ordering. And the rank orders look different. Sometimes we, maybe privilege elders over youth or youth over elders. How we do that may vary based on our cultures and our teachings and our, all of those things that make humanity beautiful and diverse. But that we categorize and then tend to rank order seems to be fairly consistent across cultures. And in Western cultures, a lot of the training and the often subtle rules about how we categorize and rank order have some content that comes from our long history of colonialism, of the kind of political economics that that built the West, right? Including transatlantic slavery, right? And including, the whole processes by which wealth was accumulated through imperialism and colonization, internal and external. And then the sorting of bodies to enable more efficient wealth accumulation in those systems has led to or kind of seem to be associated in the United States, for example. We know for sure the concepts of race emerged through that process. Who was going to be, subject to, for example, indentured servitude on the one hand, a way of keeping people in a position of, in bonded service and employment for a period of years was something that was common in the colonies in the United States, you know, during our founding. Many people from all around the world came to the United States on terms of bonds. And so you had whites who were coming and couldn't afford passage in any other way. They would bond themselves out for 5 or 7 years, but after that term, they would be free. The idea of keeping people bonded forever emerged out of that as a more efficient way. And to how to do that efficiently, how do you identify who's going to be subject to the life bond? Well, one efficient way is through something called race. So when we look at the particular way that racism and privilege evolved in the United States, I think it's important to think about all of those contextual factors, because it certainly seems, if you look closely at the history, the concepts of race in the way that we use them, got used to them, got trained to think of them conventionally over generations in the United States, were very much kind of beholden to the kind of economic systems that made race so real and so meaningful and racial identifications so materially important to profiteering. So that link, I think, is important, especially when you're thinking about what race and racism then has come to be, or, you know, was and has come to be. And so I just named that because I think often we tend to think of racism as like, well, maybe it's just ignorant thinking or just some sort of, you know, hate-based, greed-based way of just sort of thinking about us versus them. And I think those ways of thinking about it are not irrelevant. But I also think putting it in a sort of a broader, you know, economic context has proven helpful, especially when we think about race in the United States. And I think it's true more often than we realize in all of the countries that were formed through slavery, whether slavery on their land or through, you know, built up some wealth through some proximity or adjacency, some relationship to white over black slavery in particular. Because when that was part of our history, then notions of race, especially notions of whiteness and a line of whiteness that would protect us, protect those who are white from that kind of treatment, became very important. So fast forward to today, where those systems have been disrupted, the mental imprints of them often kind of remain, as have some of you know, inequalities in terms of resource distribution, where the wealth is and where the wealth continues to be, let's say, compounded, right? The sort of, even though we've dismantled those systems by and large, through which you would have this kind of, certainly enslavement as a way, is by and large dismantled, although there were many people who will say there are still trafficking, there are still patterns that we need to be mindful of today. But in to the degree that we are in a kind of a post-slavery era, people could have the question, why are we talking about it? Why is that relevant to think about race and racism? Well, I think, you know, many psychologists have helped us see that, you know, once you have identified bodies according to the rules, if you will, and mores and practices that supported, that has such meaning for so long. And by the way, once the way we've identified those bodies and linked them into those value hierarchies, to the degree that those identifying markers, colors, you know, embodied colors, we now opened ourselves up in the West to a whole way in which we already have notions of what whiteness as color, right, means through our culture, through our stories, through our narratives, through our, you know, our religions versus blackness or darkness as a color. In other words, it's not only the economics, but the kind of cultural narratives that rush in whenever the symbology of color is tied also into all of it. So because for all these reasons, there's a lot of sort of unconscious material running through us, impinging on us, that I think makes it more challenging than we realize to meet each other in ways that are not in some ways infected by ideas of us versus them that, you know, kind of rhyme with all of these deep teachings, these subconscious trainings about who matters and what colors matter more and why. And so I think whenever we talk about racism, we talk about privilege, it seems to me to be important to kind of be willing to bring our best, like whatever we have available, to kind of make ourselves a little more aware. Let's bring that to bear on how, you know, these identity-based terms, whether about race and racism, whether about gender, whether about sex orientation, you know, notions of class, religion, immigration. There's so many categories nowadays. So it just seems that because it's so much more difficult to kind of be rational about these things than is advertised, I think bringing practices like, you know, awareness practices, compassion practices to bear becomes really, really important.
Mm. I really appreciate the way that you, the arc of your explanation there, the way where you began and the way that you sort of just took us through this, that kind of understanding. And it really sort of opens my eyes even just hearing you discuss that, because it sort of has some sort of origins in just a kind of a categorizing thing,
yes.
Which looks innocuous in a way, but you know, then you couple categorizing with rank ordering, and then yeah. Things start to kind of become more clear, and then you start to weave in economic kind of imperatives into that, and let alone the cultural, and it becomes kind of more ingrained unconsciously, and all of a sudden, you know, it becomes much more dire situation, and you sort of seem to be kind of delineating a little bit, I guess, the more explicit or obvious version of perhaps, you know, kind of hateful sort of things between people or between groups, versus something that's much more kind of systemic, I guess. And I mentioned to you before we started that I was at the Mind and Life Summer Research Institute, where you presented and kind of led a number of discussions and so on. And one of the little facts that I learned there is redlining, I think it's called, that yeah. Notion of redlining, and the way that even today, that still has the ripple effects. And I wonder, is that sort of almost like an example there of yeah. a more specific example of the sort of things you're talking about?
Yes, for sure. So redlining being the practice, certainly, again, in the context that I'm familiar with here in the United States, by which a kind of a complex of institutions, our banks, like that we're responsible for. Redlining has to do with districts on the ground, which were became racially identifiable in ways that fit into our real estate markets, and therefore enlisted a complex of institutions, the real estate brokers, the banks, the police, into like, so they kind of intertwined efforts to make certain areas, you know, economically viable and racially identifiable for purposes of sustaining our real estate markets. So you had literally, you know, white neighborhoods and non-white neighborhoods. So whether they be mixed or specifically identifiable as Black or Asian, right? Many places around the world have something like, you know, a part of town that's identifiable by an Asian ethnicity, whether it be a Chinatown or a Koreatown or a Japantown. We have these. In the U.S., Yeah. And in the U.S., these were not accidental creations. They were intentional, and they were intentionally sort of created, maintained as an example of one of the ways that the real estate market and the mortgage market kind of got in there to maintain these things. In the United States, there were covenants, languages presented or included in the contracts by which land was purchased and sold, which amounted to an agreement by purchaser, by seller and purchaser, never to allow the property to be sold to people who were not white, for example. So mm-hmm. these were called, you know, racially restrictive covenants that ran with the property deeds. And I happen to, you know, live in a home that if I look at the covenants from generations ago, they certainly applied to this home. They applied to this neighborhood to keep this neighborhood for a very long time, all white. So to be unavailable for any amount of money, no matter how much money I might have had generations ago. And in fact, we have, as an example, you know, we have professional sports figures who in the U.S. and all around the world often end up with lots of money and fame. In San Francisco, we have this baseball team called the San Francisco Giants. And one of the best known baseball ballers from the 1950s, his name was Willie Mays. You can look at Willie Mays. He has an international reputation for just being this fantastic baseball player. He moved to San Francisco. And he tried to purchase a home. I could see the home he purchased from mine, basically. It's at the other end of the street. And it was in the late 1950s. He was a huge, they were accepting him on the baseball field or diamond. That was becoming a new thing to have integrated baseball players at the time. But then having him move into this neighborhood was not acceptable. So he faced physical threats, people throwing things into his home, rocks, and, you know, really trying to make him uncomfortable. And he didn't stay. Mm-hmm. So those racially restrictive covenants, even when they started to be, because by the time Willie Mays moved here, the Supreme Court had finally said those are no longer constitutional. But just because the law had changed, by then you've trained everybody into who belongs where. You have associated your own nest egg, your own investment, right? The money that you put into a home, you've associated that with keeping out a certain type of people because the other types of people will bring the value of the home down, et cetera, et cetera. So, and that was years ago. And yet to this day, I'm here, but I'm one of the few in this part of town who look like me, you know, so. Once in place, in other words, once we put something like this redlining, which is massively impactful, it's got finance, it's got social pieces, it's got all kinds of money, your future, your children, schools, right? Whether or not you've got a good school or not, title. It has such an impact that you can remove the restrictive covenants in the deeds. You can say they're unconstitutional. You can try and teach everyone that racism is a bad thing. And yet actually desegregating the neighborhoods that were segregated by a result of redlining has proven very, very hard to do.
Yeah. It's not just the law, I guess, is it? Although that was a really important step, and it sounds like some time ago, but the disrupting is a kind of it's sort of a disrupting, isn't it? Because it continues. We're still having to kind of explore and break down some of those almost social kind of cultural norms or something like that.
And also economic incentives, because again, some neighborhoods are more, you know, are valued more highly if they are, you know, less diverse.
I'm not sure if I'm about to quote you exactly correctly, but I feel like I remember in listening to another podcast that you were on. It might have been the Glow Show, is that the name? Or the Glow Podcast?
I've done a Glow podcast.
Yeah, and you sort of mentioned something like You know, if you kind of feel like social injustice isn't really sort of relevant to you, it might be good to have a bit of a closer look, basically, something like that. And I suppose this is where mindfulness starts to come into it, sort of that awareness practice and being able to sort of notice and become aware and sort of non-judgmentally, but just sort of explore. Would you be able to sort of, elaborate a bit on that piece, the sort of the mindfulness and social justice and the interactions there?
Yeah, well, thank you so much, because I mean, now we're pointing, when I hear you ask about this, it makes me think about why would someone necessarily feel inspired to take a closer look? I mean, as I heard you say that, I'm like, yeah, but what would be the reason that somebody want to do that, right? Other than like to just sort of have a moment of like, I'm a good person, and so I really care. But really, when the rubber meets the road, what are some of the underlying incentives and disincentives for taking a closer look? Because I may or may not have been mentioning this in the GLOW podcast, but one of the underlying experiential moments that feeds a statement like you're pointing to that I may have made there about maybe take a closer look. Was an experience I had in a session with a white racialized man where the invitation was to, reflect on what happens in terms of, bring your mindfulness to explore and to become more aware of what happens in the body when someone brings up the topic of race and invites you to think about what you know about racism. It's just one example. Invitation. What do you know about racism? And in the session, this one young white man was generous and, kind of felt brave and honest enough to share that as he paused and reflected, he noticed his habitual way he responds to a question like that would be to say, I don't know anything about racism. I'm a white man. I haven't seen it. I've lived in a mostly white area. I don't know. But as we sat together, what he shared was that he was able to see that it wasn't that he didn't know. It was that he was actively avoiding or turning away from acknowledging what it is. So this is a very subtle thing to become aware of, because it's very easy to say, I just have no idea. How would I know? I'm a white person. I haven't seen it. And I've heard that from, people who, and not only white racialized people. I think there is a way in which we can, again, for a lot of reasons, in conventional conversation, we may be in situations where we're better off not knowing. We may be punished somehow, socially ostracized a little bit. There could be social consequences for knowing things, or for speaking about what we know. And so for a variety of, or it could just be uncomfortable. You'd rather not get into the discomfort of it. You might rather just, cruise along and not have to deal with something that's rather, can be rather unpleasant and, disorienting if you don't have to, right? You might want to avoid it simply. It might just be avoidance behavior. Whatever it is, that moment of recognizing, this may not be the truest or most honest description of what is going on here. Is part of sort of why I think one of my takeaways is like, we all know in our bones a lot more about how our society works than we often are given space to talk about. As I was saying, there are many ways we get, trained in speaking about certain things and not speaking about certain things. So I can just pause right there and just in this conversation, those who might be listening, just think about the subtle trainings that we may have gotten in our family of origin, or maybe if not there, if that was a place where you felt safe to talk about just about everything, which for most people was not true, the family I grew up in. But even if you felt safe enough And maybe it was in a church setting or a school setting, right? Or with your peers, right? Our peer groups, the ways we get socialized into what we can talk about, what we got, and who belongs and who doesn't in those peer groups often can be even at odds with all the things that we're trying to be taught elsewhere. So pausing then and giving ourselves some kind of spacious support and permission to see a little bit more of what there is to see, to acknowledge a little bit more of what we know, I think is really, really, really important. But again, why would we want to do that? For me, mindfulness is about a kind of an ethical commitment to being, not just being aware and present, which is, you know, kind of great and exciting for me as a human being. Oh, I want to. That's, you know, it's a nice incentive. Like, so I don't miss things and I can be more, you know, joyfully alive. But there's also a kind of ethical invitation to, you know, try and minimize harm in the world. Try and, you know, do what we can to minimize suffering. And I'm going to plug in my power cord because I don't want to have one of those suffering moments where it's a conversation to power that. So anyway, yeah. So, I do think mindfulness can help us become aware of some of the ways we trick ourselves and even deceive ourselves, deny things that we actually do know. But there is this question about, well, why would we go through that? I mean, if we've been tricking ourselves, maybe we've been tricking ourselves for a reason. Or if we've been avoiding, maybe we've been avoiding. So I think having some serious conversations about, like, why would you? And is there something that our mindfulness practices or commitments might say about the why that might be worth thinking about?
Yes, the see what we see, acknowledge what we know, you know, that's a really nice kind of catchphrase in a sense. And I think I know you're a sort of a follower of John Kabat-Zinn. I think he was one of your early teachers or mentors. Yes. And you feel very
sure.
And one of the things that I've often noticed about his definition of mindfulness is that it sort of leans into sort of the non-judgmental and so on. And at least the kind of the pithy definition doesn't speak as much about the care and discernment or the kind of the ethical piece that you're referring to there. And maybe that's where the sort of the mindfulness and compassion come together, partly the motivator to look, to take a closer look. And by the way, I think that was the feeling from what you were saying. But the motivation to do that, maybe that comes from a compassionate motivation, from a very genuine wish to, you know, alleviate and prevent suffering. And sort of it's the bringing together of the mindfulness and the compassion. And they're sort of in there anyway, but.
I think you're absolutely right. I have been thinking quite a lot about what is conventionally kind of what comes together around the idea of ethics lately. And it does seem, you know, if we sort of aren't too put off by some of the ways that idea or that term or that concept seems to be about rulemaking and, you know, priggish, like judging people. And because there are some ways that I think, especially in the United States, we're sort of, we don't like to talk about ethics. You know, we feel like this is where, you know, a school mom is going to come in and make me feel bad. I don't want to feel judged, right? We're talking about non-judgmental awareness. And now here comes the ethicist to tell us we didn't do it right now, right? We didn't do it right. But, and so, I think there are ways that culturally conversations about ethics have to kind of dress themselves, have to sort of slide in through the door that's left slightly ajar somehow. But if we don't actually, if we can, and there are ways that we can sort of invite reflecting on it that doesn't necessarily require that we use the big E word. And one way is to talk about, you know, compassion. Because, and the reason why I think it really is a way to get us into the same conversation is when you look at what we call ethics, which I think is really just, you know, a placeholder for explicit conversations about the aspirations we have to act in ways that manifest our highest and best, right? You know, it's about whether we're talking about ethics or morality, it's about being willing to talk about some vision we have of the good, some vision we have of the, you know, the better or the best that we can try and offer in a moment. And, you know, to sort of cultivate a willingness to sort of try and act in alignment with those things. And I think because mindfulness is often is really about cultivating some version of non-judgmentality, I think it can get a little bit bollocks, like there can be a little bit of tension, right? But for me, you know, the non-judgment piece of mindfulness is not about, you know, the idea that we never bring a quality of kind of something like judgment to bear on our evaluation of what we are doing and what others are doing in the world. You know, sometimes I, in my work, use the word discernment. Others do as well for that aspect, right? So judgment in the definition of mindfulness or alluded to in the non-judgmentality that we're talking about when we use John Kabat-Zinn's definition of mindfulness. You know, what he's talking about there is sort of how we might meet a given moment, right? How we might suspend judgment for the moment so that we can see things more clearly, have an attitude of open friendliness, purposeful awareness. But it's not meant to suggest we never then take a moment to put that, what we see in some sort of evaluative framework or context and discern, well, is this something I want to do again, repeat again, affirm, vote for, right? So we do have to, in fact, as we move through the world, make choices. And there's an evaluative piece of that. So because of that, some conversations about, you know, ethics and morality are worthwhile. But even if we don't use those terms, when we look at what ethics or moral behavior seems to be calling for, at the core, you often find, or maybe the thing you find most often across cultures, is a way of describing how we would act to respond to the suffering of another person. Or a way of describing different policies or practices we would enact to minimize the suffering of another person or ourselves, right? Because there are ways that we want to take care of ourselves. But certainly, when we talk about ethics and morality, we're often looking at the interpersonal dynamics of our, you know, actions and the, you know, the impact of them. So, you know, often it is like, what are the different ways? And here, I think less words or less in the way of a framework than more, at least is what appeals to me right now. Like I'm less interested in a whole big nuanced set of rules about ethics. I'm more interested in conversations that sensitize us to the reality that in a life, well-lived or half-well-lived, in any human life, there will be many opportunities to meet suffering in our midst, in ourselves, in our neighborhood, around the corner, in our families, in our social world, in the political realm, through the choices we make. And to me, ethics, in a way, is simply inviting us to be more conscious of what we are doing, to act in ways that courageously seek to minimize suffering. What are we doing? What are we not doing? Because that's another part of it. Not just what we consciously do. It's like the inactions that have an ethical implication.
Yes, alleviating and preventing suffering kind of is just. And so that's the kind of the sort of the compass that we're following there is to try to do that and sort of ethics or you know those kind of things. It's really coming back to that very core notion: may I be helpful rather than harmful. Basically, isn't it in a sense? You know, and sort of do things or stop doing things that maybe I'm now aware are doing more harm. The thing I loved about your example with the young man who you had that conversation with was you stayed very evocative. You know, you weren't trying to lecture him about ethics in any way. You were being curious, you were listening, you were creating a safe space, and he was then able to tap into a bit of courage, I suspect, because, you know, it does, like you say, it's a courageous thing to do, but he was able to tap into some of that and then feel safe to explore and to explore his inner world and what really is in there. Although your wonderful book, The Inner Work of Racial Justice, it's sort of, that's the inner work. Is that sort of really what's that piece about?
Yeah. Well, definitely we're describing some of it. Like, so, yes. Well, actually we're describing kind of different aspects of it, I think. So maybe a part of it is cultivating the capacity to help be a space around which or within which the truth can, some measure, some greater, more courageous truth can be spoken.
Uh-huh.
So cultivating within ourselves the ability to be more open to others is what I'm pointing to here. And to me, there's some inner work in that, because most of us have been trained to, you know, and again, often it's very unconscious, it's not so explicit, the different ways we're trained, but we have biases. We're oriented toward like, yes, I want to hear more of this person's story. Oh my God, I'm really going to have a problem listening to that person's story. Or, you know, and in different ways, maybe more comfortable creating space for certain experiences than others. So cultivating that capacity to be a space where whatever truth needs to be, oh, this person's truth is, he's been walking through a world unaware of his own kind of blind spot and avoiding engagement with social injustice. So being a kind of creating a space where someone can say that, as opposed to, you know, feeling like, oh my gosh, it's not safe for me to say that because I can tell that this person only wants me to say a certain thing, only wants to hear a certain thing from me. So how is it that we are formed, or we can better cultivate the ability to be more open if that is our responsibility or something we've chosen in a role that we've occupied? So if we're mindfulness facilitators, or if we're leaders in any way, I think cultivating an ability to be a space where people can speak the truth is important. It's hard to do because in most places, there's some penalty, either explicit or implicit, for what then might be shared. So in a workplace setting, we try to bring these mindfulness conversations in. I get invited into workplaces to offer sessions on this. I'm aware that it is much harder than, again, is advertised, right? To create a space at that workplace where people can speak the truth. Because even in the, you know, we close the conference room door and we keep the bosses, the official bosses out. Can you trust that people in this space will not listen to something you said and either hold it against you when you're not in this little room and conference room and session, or gossip about it, talk to someone, right? Mm. So creating trustworthy spaces is not easy. And I think we are so bereft of places like, and we get therefore trained in not being able to do it or not being able to come in when we sort of feel like maybe this is a safer place. Well, I don't know. Is it? You know? Mm. So there's an inner work there. But then on the other side, which we were pointing to a little bit more explicitly, the inner work around when someone's giving you a space to be able, yes, to say, oh, wow, okay, here I can let down my guard a little bit. I mean, this person doesn't hold any cards over me, right? Or any, isn't in no position to retaliate against me. This is a relative. Can I acknowledge can I acknowledge that maybe some shame here that might be, keep me unable to acknowledge? And this is where self-compassion is really important.
I was about to ask,
isn't it? And research shows that, right? Yes. We can cultivate the ability to say, wow, this is something that I don't like seeing in myself, but I'm here for myself. And I'm not the first person. Everybody has these things within that they don't feel reflect them in their best light. So cultivating a way of being with ourselves as we are acknowledging these things is important. And I think it's ongoing. I mean, it's just, I am in this with y'all, with everybody within the hearing of this voice. Just know that I'm not talking about something that I'm somehow like elevating myself above. No, yeah. I'm a human being. We're all, we're in this. There's always, you think of all of the challenges over time. I'm thinking for some reason, the quote of his name is, I'm going to say it wrong, but I think it's La Rochefoucauld, who was I think 18th century French philosopher known for aphorisms about morality. And the one that my partner and I were talking about recently was where he is, a translation of his that we heard recently repeated, that hypocrisy is the compliment that vice pays to virtue, right? But this idea being that, we're all tempted to be hypocritical because we want to be a certain kind of way.
Yes.
We know what the virtuous is. We know what it is. And so we speak to it and we try to do it as best we can. But there's some part of us that has a bit of that, let's call it vice, let's call it bias, let's call it habit, condition of doing the opposite. So we can be hypocritical because we know what to say. That doesn't mean we always know what to do. But we disrupt all those habits and patterns and conditions.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, there's something so important. It's kind of like the inner work is still about interconnectedness. It's still about relationship. It's still about and still about love. It's still about safeness. It's about having that trustworthy, safe space of love, but amongst us, that allows us all to feel strong and courageous enough to go there and to kind of explore things that might be very painful. It might create a real awareness of our own hypocrisy and perhaps even the shame that goes along with that. It also means that if I acknowledge that I know that, then that means I do have to do something about it. And so that's difficult as well. And so all sorts of emotions arise. I think Paul Gilbert, who is someone I'm very sort of keen on and a follower of, he sort of says, compassion is the courage to descend into the reality of what it is to be human, sort of thing. We're the inner work is really going to those places that might kind of be very, very uncomfortable, actually. But we want to go there because that's the way towards less suffering and preventing suffering, and that's what it's sort of all about.
Yeah, absolutely, and beautiful. And I think, I can't help but be feeling wanting something, some call to just name again that compassion seems so important because of the ways that, there is so much risk. Once we speak, when we go beyond doing this work alone, when we are doing it interpersonally or in the world in any kind of way, again, if we're thinking about conventional ways of fitting in or being successful, then there's often something on the line, right? Something, acceptance in this place, in this workplace. I mean, I have heard recently I've been thinking about the intersection actually between mindfulness, Buddhism on the one hand, and Christian based teachings on the other. And this is simply because I'm doing some healing work in my own history, in my own heritage. I grew up in a Christian home.
Mm.
And I have come to study Buddhism and mindfulness, obviously. But bringing some of those teachings together has felt like a call of this part of my life. And so, you know, for me, it meant a number of things. Certainly, looking particularly at some of the stories from, you know, the teachings of Jesus about love and love thy neighbor, and, you know, all of these kinds of ways of bringing that kind of that quality to bear in how we are in our ethical commitments, the actual care for the other person. I've been thinking about that, but I've also been reading about some of the ways that injustice of the sort that we've been talking about here has been something that the churches have been challenged around, like how to, you know, what role the church, right, in the face of all of these sorts of, you know, inequalities and identity-based wrongs. And just reading one particular book in which some white seminarians today in a contemporary United States being asked, where are you standing? How are you standing up against the resurgence of white nationalism here? The renormalization of racism, which is happening in some quarters here and traveling under religious, you know, sort of authority in some spaces, some quarters, the sort of Christian white nationalism. So just reading this one piece in this, there was a conversation being had where some young white religious teachers were saying, I would like to bring these themes in. I would like to talk about the value of anti-racism or minimizing racial bias in my church sermons, but it's not safe for me to do it in this parish or with this church, with this particular religious community. And I need to keep my job.
Mm-hmm.
So this is to say that I know that we live in a world which can make it really hard, actually, for us to live the things that we believe, for us to speak truth, certainly to power. That is a phrase out there for a reason. Mm-hmm. It is not easy to do. And so that, I think, I have been meditating quite a lot with what does it really take to be more courageous, not only in our own private explorations. Am I willing to go into these more shadowy places in my own psyche, in my own reflective space? But what am I willing, you know, to really, where am I willing to take risks that could literally cost me something in service of living the commitments of my heart and my practice? This is really, you know, it's in other words, acknowledging the true truths about the fact that we don't create the whole world. And so, you know, some of what we're talking about could upset the cart of all the things we tend to do conventionally to make ourselves okay. That job, that, you know, that feeling at ease in that neighborhood, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. So I do want to at least name, I don't have the answers to that, but I think when we have these conversations and we don't talk about that part, it can really feel a little bit like, you know, that we're virtue performing, right? We're just having a conversation that we know we're not really putting all that really can be at stake on the table. Because for many people who really live these kinds of commitments, well, they had already decided not to, you know, march by the drums of conventional society. In mindfulness, we're often saying, well, you can just bring a little bit of mindfulness and keep your life more or less the same. But when we really start getting into these hard ethical questions and, you know, these questions of how we live our values, you know, we're not going to unpack it all here, but we know it's starting to point towards the kinds of questions that if you pull at them, really start to unravel some of the ways we've wrapped ourselves in a comfortable blanket and, you know, might not want to really, if we're really pressed, might not want to change, might not want to have to take. These are risks that we don't want to necessarily have.
Safeness is important, but courage is often the key in a sense, you know, and sometimes it's not as fruitful to wait for safeness to arrive, you know, like that actually sometimes there is the courage to take steps, and that can mean sacrifice, you know, to one or other degree. But, you know, is there a way to still take steps build upon it? I suppose we don't necessarily have to go the whole way in the first step, maybe, but moving, progressing, disrupting, you know, continuing forward. I have got a lot to think about with this conversation. It's really very moving and also inspiring. I'm sure people will be thinking, you know, like, what is it that I could do, you know, like in my own world to sort of just progress things a little bit along the way? If people were wanting to, you know, sort of engage with you and your work, there is the book, which I will have linked in the description. And how might people sort of connect or read more or hear more of your stuff?
Well, like as is conventionally the thing to do, I do have a website where I'm trying to make sure I keep people apprised of what's going on in my life. I don't do the best job of it, but I try. But RhondaVMcGee.com is a place where I put my events, and I'm excited to be offering an online three-series session of courses with the Spirit Rock Meditation Center, which is based here in California. But again, it's an online offering. This will happen in November. And it'll be on these, you know, I call it the big three, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion.
Okay.
And looking at the deepening our capacity to update, if you will, our way of practicing within, you know, the subtle manifestations of greed, of aversion, if not hatred, you know, or of just, you know, that temptation to kind of have that subtle bias, that is a soft version, right? If hatred is not what we're experiencing. And then delusion, you know, the many different ways subtle deception of self or other is so seductive right now. Like, maybe I don't see this. Okay, I do see it. So greed, hatred, delusion is going to be featured in this set of teachings through Spirit Rock this November. I'm actually working on creating a way of bringing together folks who are interested in bringing mindfulness to bear on the hardest problems of our time. I think most of us are interested in doing that. But creating a kind of a particular place online and network, I'm using the name Mount Iris for that part of my project. So if you see on my website, Rhonda V. McGee, and then an opportunity to look into Mount Iris, that's part of my work that's about really creating a collaborative network so that we can learn from what others are doing. We can develop our own practices together and learn through courses and experiences together. So I'm working on all of that. I'd love kind of meeting new people along the way and staying in connection. So I'd love to stay connected with you, my dear.
Yes. No, lovely. I've long wanted to go to Spirit Rock. I haven't had the chance yet, but maybe I can attend online and have a That is that what you've described there kind of is a chunk of the inner work, isn't it? You know, is it to is. Work with those three, greed, hatred, and delusion, and that community sounds wonderful.
Yeah, I think fear is actually the secret little thing that's under greed often. So we'll be talking about.
Yeah, that's really, that's good. Yeah, I think fear and sort of hence courage, I suppose, in a way, isn't it, really? And do you have, just a cheeky question, I mean, do you have any other writing on the way, other books or anything like that?
I have lots of things. Yeah, I mean, I don't have anything under contract or in contract ready to go right away. But I am working on, another book.
Another little project.
Yeah, and it really is touching and concerning that what we're talking about now, it's really pointing to, you know, more of the roots. In fact, the working title was The Roots of Well-Being. But yeah, so it's really deepening our ability through these traditional practices and having more of a conversation across different types of traditions. So as I was saying, that Buddhist, Christian, in other words, to sort of invite, if for many of us, we're bringing together, we come from some heritage, we found another, we are in these multicultural awakening processes in lives. And so for me, watering those roots is has been about like creating some way of letting it all be part of what sustains us, not feeling like, you know, cut off entirely whatever we, before we found, you know, this new way, but to stitch together these worlds, because I do think there's a need for actually bringing together, integrating all of who we are. It can help us when we're feeling a little alienated, bereft, and lonely to remember how rich we all are, to remember the miracle that we are and that we've come through to where we happen to be. So really exploring how to deepen our roots in those rich ways.
Yes. Roots of well-being. I love that. Well, Professor Rhonda McGee, thank you very much for coming and speaking with me on Compassion in a T-shirt.
Thank you. I've been honored and I appreciate this conversation and all of the work that you're doing, my dear. So thank you very much.
Thank you.